You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
It was very much stressed that we were going to engage an enemy that was moving fast, and we were going to have to shoot accurately and keep shooting.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. Welcome to episode 38 of Cold War Conversations. Today we are talking to Neil Gussman, who trained on the M60A1 tank in the 1970s. This was the standard main battle tank of the US Army from the 1960s through to the 1980s. If you're enjoying these podcasts, you can get exclusive extras, including previews of future episodes and content that didn't make the final cut. This is available for as little as a monthly donation of a euro, a dollar, or a quid. However, larger amounts and other currencies are accepted too. Just head over to coldwarconversations.com and click on the Support the Podcast menu option. Thank you very much to those listeners who are already supporting us. Back to today's episode, Neil shares with us some great anecdotes about his training and the gunnery competitions he was involved in, as well as the change in US tank tactics as a result of the learnings from the 1973 Arab-Israeli War. I'm delighted to welcome Neil Gussman.
In America, the Vietnam War is very much part of the Cold War, as is, you know, the Korean War, the conflict in Grenada. They all work in. So when I enlisted during the time that America had a draft, just 3 years before the draft ended, but I enlisted from a suburb just north of Boston. And if you know anything about the way Americans serve, two-thirds or nearly two-thirds of the military is from the 11 states of the old Confederacy and a few states in the West. So people don't serve as much from the, particularly the northeastern states, and during Vietnam, not at all. So I graduated in 1971 from Stoneham High School, and there were 371 kids who graduated, and there were two of us who served during the Vietnam War. And in some southern high schools, half the boys served during Vietnam. So anyway, we were quite unusual. So Murray Hubbard, the other kid, he enlisted, went to Vietnam, and came back home perfectly healthy. I enlisted in the Air Force, never got closer to Vietnam than Utah, but I came home in bandages because I did live fire missile testing and one of the tests went bad. So, yes, but that's how I began my military service.
All right. Okay. And as a result of that accident with the missile testing, you left the military for a while, didn't you?
I did. I left for a year and I tried being a civilian, and I missed the military. So I went to go back in, and the re-enlisting in the Air Force, I would have been an airman again. And re-enlisting in the Army, they made me a specialist one grade higher and gave me a $2,500 bonus, you know, which was an awful lot of money. So in 1975, I re-enlisted to be an armor crewman and went to Fort Knox, Kentucky for tank training.
Okay. Okay. And what was that training like? What did that entail?
Well, we were, it's a little over 2 months of training. As it happened, just because of when I enlisted, I went to Fort Knox I was there in July and August. So, A lot of the training was hands-on inside the turret of a tank. And it was, I guess, 33 Celsius, 90 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow.
Outside. And then there were 10 of us crammed in the turret of an M60A1 sometimes. I remember that because one of our drill instructors was a large man who had married a wife in Korea who cooked with kimchi, used a lot of garlic. And he said, every night I have beer and kimchi and you're not going to fall asleep in my classes. Get in here.
Wow. I mean, 10 in a turret. I can't imagine you can move in that.
Oh, you can't. Yes, but there were various things he had to tell us by showing us. So, you know, without ammunition, and I've been in other tanks, without ammunition in it, the M60A1 is a roomier turret than many other tanks. So, you know, we didn't have any ammo in the ready rack, of course, because we were training in Fort Knox. You know, back then, all 19-year-olds were skinny, so you could cram a lot of sweaty people into a turret at Fort Knox. And we learned our various lessons of the of different parts of the turret of that tank.
Right. And the M60A1 was the main battle tank of the U.S. Army in the 1970s. I understand it came from sort of like a 1960s design. Is that correct?
Yeah, it came from the M48A5, well, the M48, and to the M60 itself, which was a small variant. There weren't that many of them made. And then the M60A1 had a different turret, and that continued through the entire run of the M60 series. It went to the A3, and there were some odd variants like the A2. But yes, the main battle tank of America was the M60A1 until it was briefly replaced by the A3. And then, of course, America switched over to the M1 Abrams.
Yeah. So it really was the main battle tank of the U.S. Army during the Cold War, I guess.
Oh, sure. Through the 60s and into the 80s. As it turns out, I was on active duty until November of 79, and then I had another gap in service till 82. I spent a couple of years in an Army Reserve tank unit in Reading, Pennsylvania. Now, by that time, the active duty was all on M60A3s, but of course, this was a reserve unit. It had A1s, so all of my tank service was on an M60A1 in Germany and America. And at the time, the base we trained on in Pennsylvania, there was a National Guard tank unit, and it still had M48s.
Wow.
And back then, you know, I ended my service recently, 2007 to 16, by being in a National Guard unit, which is it's a lot. The National Guard is looked at a lot better than it used to be during Vietnam. During Vietnam, the National Guard was only barely part of the military. It was a place to go to hide from Vietnam service if you couldn't dodge the draft.
Right. And so, sorry, just going back to the M60A1, what did the crews think of them? How did you rate it as a tank?
Well, as a tank, I mean, every crew when they come into tanks, because we're all just young men that come into them, you know, you realize that a tank is the most maintenance-intensive vehicle you will ever ride in. So if you're an armor crewman, you spend all of your time, or so much of your time, tightening things that get loose and fixing things that break, that you just think, I mean, how are we ever going to fight in this? And yet, the war record of the M60A1, not with America, of course, but particularly in the 73 war, is that it's a really reliable tank. And the drivetrain in particular is very reliable. The Israeli army, from what I've read, took some captured Soviet vehicles and put American-made engines and transmissions in them and tracks, because from a maintenance standpoint, they were so much better than the Soviet alternative. So yes, from the tanks look so different from the inside than they do from the outside. From the outside, they're terrifying, but from the inside, they're endless maintenance.
Yeah, I mean, I have been inside a Chieftain turret, and that was quite interesting, just getting the feel for that. But it did seem quite a large turret, certainly compared with what I'd seen of a World War II tank.
Oh, yeah, and a Soviet tank. I mean, how much they sacrificed for having a lower profile tank. That it's so cramped in Soviet tanks. I mean, relatively. Yeah. No, but it's, So the focus of what we did, particularly in Germany, where we were training over long distances with Reforger, they load the tanks on trains, but still you were driving. And when you drive a tank, it's got, 80 track blocks, 80 center guides, 319 or 20 end connectors, that hold the track together, and wheels and all kinds of things that shake and rattle and get loose. And so
one of the main jobs, I guess, is the maintenance of the vehicle and just keeping it running, because basically your survival depends on it being able to be mobile.
Yes. So automotive maintenance at every halt, whether we were tactical or not, we would jump out and start checking end connectors, checking all the things that got loose, and making sure oil levels were right. And then, because we were in Germany for a lot of my time, making sure to wipe guns off, because it was, the humidity was somewhere around 98%, or it was just plain raining.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to libsynads.com now. That's libsynads.com.
Yeah. So, there were so many things that we just were making sure they weren't rusting, they weren't falling apart.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you were an automotive maintenance specialist no matter what the heck you did in that tank.
Right. And so, obviously, the other key area is the gunnery training. Can you tell me something about that?
Well, that was the focus of our training, and being able to fire that gun accurately and quickly was what we trained for. That once a year on active duty, and even in the reserves, it was the same thing. Annual gunnery was the big final exam for the year for tank crews. So you trained for that and focused on that, and then the honor was real. It was it wasn't equivocal like so many other things, where you have a competition and people didn't care that much. Even people who were draftees and just serving their time, they wanted to do well at gunnery before they turned their back on the army.
And the gunnery training was that was in stationary, on the move, various different types like that?
Oh, yes. It increased in levels. Now, I want to emphasize that back then on an M60A1, there were no electronic assists at all. Everything was mechanical. We had a device when the gunner was sitting in the gunner's seat, There was a white box immediately to the right of his where he sits on his right forearm. It was called a computer, but it was a metal box that had three cams in it. So you would switch from the three different types of rounds to super elevate the gun, to raise the gun to the necessary height for the distance to get the round on target. But yes, everything was mechanical. Computers were not part of what we did. So, so we were training with, to shoot on the move. I mean, in the sense that we would move from target to target, but then stop and fire, and to be proficient at seeing a target, stopping, firing, and then moving on and picking up the next target. So,
right. So you weren't able to fire whilst the tank was in motion. You had to be stationary in order to aim it accurately.
Yes. Accurate fire required you to be stationary. And that's what we trained for, was to put accurate fire on the target. So we would, driver stop was always part of a fire command. Right. Now with a machine gun, that wasn't the same, but with the main gun, you stopped, shot, and kept going, because there was no way to put accurate fire on a target if you could have, you know, run over a hump in the ground or fallen in a ditch or anything like that.
Yeah, because you see those modern tanks where the barrel's remaining sort of targeted whilst the tank is moving, but that's all the fancy modern technology that's doing that.
Yeah, and I actually, you know, got a test run in one of those, the M60A3 tanks, before I left active duty with a stabilized gun. And yeah, it was crazy that you could drive down the road and whatever the tank did, the gun stayed on target. And it also put in the super elevation. And yeah, it was just amazing to think, you know, at the time, because computers were so new, but that they had developed a computer that could stabilize a gun for a tank that was going 15 miles an hour, for instance.
Yeah.
Because when I was in, just to say, there was a job in the artillery called computer. They were six guys who sat in an M557 vehicle that followed those M109 Paladin 155 howitzers, and they computed the range and all the range and the azimuth and everything necessary to put an artillery round on target. But that was, people who did math.
Yeah, yeah. And probably with a slide rule or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, they actually had some rudimentary computers by the time I was in, but yeah, they had actual math backup.
Yeah. It's a bit like when you see that movie Apollo 13 and the technology they're dealing with there.
Yeah, and that the job title was computer.
Yeah.
So there were guys in army uniforms whose job was computer.
Wow. And yeah. So what was your expected rate of fire that you were supposed to be, you know, reach in terms of proficiency?
Oh, 2 rounds in 5 seconds. The rate of fire, I mean, it was always acquiring that final exam was you acquired a target, fired at the target. You were given 2 rounds and then moved on. So, yeah. So your rate of fire was be ready, stop the tank, shoot, and then put the second round on in within 5 seconds.
Right.
And then keep going. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Okay. And as far as tactics against, obviously, the enemy then was the Soviet Union. I mean, were there extra tactics in terms of, obviously, you want to get to the side of the, or fire in the side of the enemy, because that's normally where the armor is weaker. Were there any sort of tactics like that that were part of your training?
Well, since I enlisted in 1975, I began serving in the military, in the U.S. military, in the midst of a very big revision in armor doctrine. In 1973, I think it was 2 months after the end of the 73 war, General Don Starry, who was the head of the armor branch, went for what was going to be a short visit to look at the aftermath of that, of the battles in the Golan and the Negev. Mm-hmm. And he ended up staying quite a while and going back and bringing his staff and then rewriting armor doctrine. Our training up to that point had assumed we would be primarily engaging at longer ranges, and the what he saw in the Negev and in the Golan said that when the tank battles happened, these modern tanks move faster than their World War II counterparts. They can engage at longer ranges, but the battles ended up being very rapid and violent, and people were shooting at each other at 100 meters and, you know, just blowing the tanks to pieces, so that the ability to fire accurately and fast got it was very much stressed that we were going to engage an enemy that was moving fast, and we were going to have to shoot accurately and keep shooting.
Right.
So,
and also I understand from the Arab-Israeli War of 73, obviously the anti-tank missiles were first introduced then, and they changed tactics as well.
Oh, right. The Israelis had been, particularly on the Egyptian front, I mean, they were a surprise. The suitcase Sagar missiles were a really terrible surprise to the Israeli army, that, you know, one guy with a suitcase-looking box could engage a tank at up to 3,000 meters and destroy it. So, yes, we had big changes in that. You had to have suppressive fire on infantry, and yes, that we couldn't presume that you were engaging, you know, that the main battle would simply be tank on tank, that the battlefield was really dangerous, and, you know, that any infantryman, maybe at short range with an RPG and at long range with a Sagar, could kill the vehicle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I think you mentioned, the best day of your 18 years military service was around gunnery training. Is that correct?
Oh, it was. And it was because after I finally got out, I started thinking about, you know, what? Obviously, I had a love-hate relationship with the military, because I kept, between 72 and 2007, I got out several times. In fact, I got out in 1984 and didn't go back until 2007. So I would leave and go back, and, you know, what was a good day in the Army like? Since obviously I was happy to leave it at various points, and that tank gunnery in 1976, the first time I fired the moving tank range, what tankers call Table 8. It was within a year of my switch from the Air Force to the Army, and with inter-service rivalry is very real between the services. I mean, every service insults all of the other services, and the fact that I was Air Force, and because I joined the unit in September of 1975, after 8 weeks of tank training, I was a specialist. I didn't come in as a private. So by rank, I was assigned as a gunner. Mm-hmm. Usually the progression is you're a driver and then a loader and then a gunner and then you're a tank commander. But, you know, this was the end of the draft and they were short of people. So I had the rank, so they put me in the gunner seat with an old tank commander, so he could teach me about the tank and get me ready to be a tank commander. This old guy, you know, was grumpy and just waiting for retirement, but he was a good teacher, and I learned a lot about gunnery. But the only range I fired on was the stationary range, where you line up a tank company, 17 tanks.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Side by side, fender to fender, and fire at stationary targets just to get ready for annual gunnery. So in February, before gunnery, I got promoted to sergeant. I got my own crew, and I really wanted to do well. You know, the Air Force guy, the, as they referred to me, without four-letter words, the wingnut. You know, I wanted to be the wingnut who fired distinguished. So I actually read the operator's manual of that tank. I was obsessed with it. So the 700-page manual, the manual number is 92350215-10. Yeah, I was. So I read the entire manual so nothing would go wrong that I had within my control, and I just drilled my crew. You know, when other crews got off, I would take my crew and drill them in the manual of getting ready, particularly the gunner. So we trained and trained and went to that Table 8 gunnery in the desert of Fort Carson, Colorado. The most practiced crew. And my gunner at the time was one of those draftees who just wanted to leave the military. His, I don't remember what his first name was because everybody called him Merc. He could run really fast. So he was Mercury Morris. And he was a specialist. And well, the names that we usually used for him, I don't know if you have, if you have four-letter word restrictions in your podcast, but he was, he never ironed his uniform. In a day when soldiers starched their green uniforms, he was always wrinkled. And in everything about being a soldier, he was a mess, but he was a really good gunner. Right. And so Merck and I trained and trained on moving targets, on stationary targets, and he was getting out 2 months after this gunnery was over. And even though he hated the Army, he decided that he would, you know, try to fire distinguished. And I got him to believe that if he could fire distinguished with a wingnut tank commander, that that would be really like lifting his middle fingers to the Army and saying, see, you don't have to iron your clothes to be good at this. So
that's
yes. And
go on.
Yeah. And we did. Yes, we did that. The Table 8 gunnery, we went through the entire engagement. And one of the great things about Merck is he was a smart kid, and he could do the math in his head to use the telescopic sight. We had to do one engagement with the telescope, and I just called a range to him. And with a normal computer, I would set the range in the stereoscopic rangefinder at the top of the turret, and he would just have to put the crosshairs on target. But with that telescopic sight, I gave him a range, and he had to put the correct crosshair on target and adjust if there wasn't a range line, you know, with the number I gave him. And he could do that. He was really comfortable with the telescopic sight. So a lot of times when people missed, they missed with the telescope. And Merck was good with that. And he was also good with, we had to fire the longest shot at nearly 2,000 meters was with the high explosive plastic, the high explosive round, which was the slowest round we shot. So it was a long shot on a high arc. And he hit that target with the first round. And that was near the end. And when he hit that, I knew we had it, because he had hit everything else. And usually, like with SABO rounds, those armor-piercing rounds, the muzzle velocity is 5,300 feet per second. You can just barely see them. You know, as soon as you blink, they're through the target. But that HEP round, I watched that for a few seconds go way up in the air and go right through that
and
panel.
Was he the gunner you took with you to West Germany?
Absolutely not. He got out 2 months later and, turned his back on the Army and was... Nobody was happier to leave the Army than him.
Yeah, he'd done his one finger up at the Army, and that was it.
That was it. Yes, he was genuinely delighted. He'd never fired distinguished before, and you know, he was arguably our platoon sergeant. It was a sergeant first class stipe. You know, he was the other reason that that I could shoot that well. Because he had been a tanker since before Vietnam. He'd been a tanker in Vietnam. And he was also a master gunner. So he knew all of the variables that you could control for to get that gun to shoot accurately. When we zeroed the gun, we shot at a 1,000-meter panel. And we had three rounds. And there's a 2-foot circle in the middle of it. And, you know, because the preparation was so good with Sergeant Stipe, the first three rounds, we didn't have to do any more. We put three rounds in a 2-foot circle and we were ready to shoot. So,
wow.
Yes. So we had, so going into this gunnery, I was in the platoon of the best platoon sergeant. I had the guy who I thought was the best gunner. So I was really ready, and I trained for it, and so my first gunnery out, I fired distinguished, which is you hit it all but one or all of the targets, but you hit at least 95% of the targets, and it puts you in the top 10% of the battalion or the division, depending on which unit you're in.
Right. Okay. Okay, and so you progress. So you're tank commander. I'm familiar with sort of like World War II, where the tank commander is looking out of the turret. In a M60A1, is it all buttoned down when you're in action?
No, I mean we train to do operations with the hatches closed, but routinely, no, we had our heads out. At least I did. The best way to adjust fire was to have your head out. If you were looking out through gun slits, watching the SABO round, the armor piercing round, go down range, it was hard to see. It was hard to see that tracer go down range, even in the most clear circumstances. So when we had the option, and certainly on any training exercise, we had the hatches open.
Well, that's all we had time for, but that's not the end of Neil's story. We have a further episode coming soon where Neil talks about his deployment to West Germany, including a nervy incident on the inner German border. Don't miss that. Don't forget to check out the show notes for this episode, which includes some photos of Neil and some interesting videos of the M60A1 tank. The show notes are at coldwarconversations.com/episode and the number 38. If you like what you are listening to, do join our Facebook discussion group where there's loads of Cold War information and further discussions with listeners and guests.
just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. And we're also on Twitter at Cold War Pod. And our newest social media account is on Instagram at Cold War Conversations. Lastly, if you like what you're hearing, do leave reviews with your podcast provider and share us via social media. It really helps to increase awareness of the podcast. I'd like to thank our recent reviewers, including Chris Millington, UK. Thank you very much for listening and supporting the podcast. It is much appreciated. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.